ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. My name is Hal Bryan, and I'm one of your hosts. I'm EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications, and seated right here next to me, it is...
I am Sam Olson. I am the senior editor within our publications department.
And Sam, we are proud and beyond privileged to welcome a very distinguished guest to the show, almost certainly the highest ranking guest we have ever had. It is our honor to welcome General Kenneth Wilsbach, who is the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force. General Wilsbach, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Hal. Thanks, Sam. I listen to your podcast. Every new episode that comes out, I listen to it. I just love listening to it and being a part of aviation. And so I'm really thrilled and delighted to be with you today.
Well, if this were a book, that would be a blurb on the dust jackets. So we sure appreciate hearing that. So one of the things that we like to do whenever we meet somebody in aviation, we all have a passion for it and an interest in it and some involvement in it. But give us just a little bit of your aviation origin story. You know, were you a kid playing with models, or what was that first exposure?
Absolutely. Well, my dad was a Navy pilot. And so I was about 3 years old when he went to Pensacola to go to pilot training. And every little kid picture of me from that era, I have an airplane in my hand of some sort. And I had toy airplanes when I was really little. And then I started building models. And of course, he was involved with general aviation most of his career. And I remember being in the second grade and going for my first general aviation ride with him in a Cessna 150 in Pensacola. And doing stalls and spins in a 150. It was really fun, as I recall. And then later on, he purchased a Piper Archer, and I was his autopilot. And I had to sit on foam cushions to see over the dash, but he would take off and let me fly. And my mom and my sister would sit in the back. And so I always wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be a military pilot. And when it got time to figure out which service I would go into, everyone thought I would go into the Navy because my dad was in the Navy. And we had a sit down, and he actually encouraged me to go into the Air Force. And it made sense because one of my grandfathers was in the Marines. The other was in the Navy. I had two uncles in the Army. And so to round out our joint family, we needed an airman. So I picked the Air Force. And I fully intended to go to pilot training and serve out my initial commitment, which at the time was about 10 years. And after that, I wanted to go to the airlines. And that plan lasted after my first mission in the T-37, we did some aerobatics, and that was all over. And I had to do some aerobatics for the rest of my life, which I have done. And so I was very fortunate to get an F-15 out of pilot training. Oh, wow. And spent almost the very first several decades flying the F-15, but then had an opportunity to fly the MC-12 for one assignment in Afghanistan. Then I converted to the F-22 and later the F-16 and back to the F-22, which is what I'm current in right now.
That's fantastic.
Along the way, I stayed very active in general aviation. Every place where there was an Air Force Aero Club, I was a member. In fact, I was the most favored member because I spent so much money there. as I got back from overseas a few years ago, I purchased a Lance Air Legacy, which I've owned for about 2.5 years. And I just have thoroughly enjoyed aircraft ownership. Despite the expense, I still love it.
Hear, hear. Well, General, we, of course, thank you and your extended family for your service, for covering just about all the branches. It sounds like maybe you need a nephew in the Coast Guard and maybe somebody in Space Command at some point.
And Space Force.
Space Force, excuse me, yes.
You know, General, as we kind of look at, you know, your experience and of course you just went through some of it, but one of the things that stuck out to me is, 71 combat missions over your career, as part of a couple different operations. I mean, can you talk a little bit about, your experience, overseas?
And so my first combat experience was as the second in command of a fighter squadron, an F-15 squadron. And then I went back as a squadron commander. All those missions were over Iraq for Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch. That was to enforce, if you recall, the no-fly zones in northern and southern Iraq. And so we were, as a part of an F-15 squadron, we would fly into Iraq and make sure that the Iraqis didn't fly. And oftentimes they would shoot either missiles or anti-aircraft artillery at us. And I still remember the first mission, and I know all of my colleagues in 71 missions, you know, compared to many people these days, it's not that many. But we all probably have the, you know, the same sort of sense of, you know, what you're about to do before you actually go fly into somebody else's country uninvited, which is, you know, the fighter pilot's prayer, which is, God, please help me not to screw up, or something to that effect. Yes.
Thank you for using the family-friendly version of that, of course. But, and I think anybody who's flown has probably said that under some circumstance or other. But I suppose mercifully for most of us, it's not in a combat situation. It maybe just around a first solo or something. You know, please just let me do it right. Now, you mentioned the was it the MC-12? Am I remembering correctly? Was that correct? The MC-12 or 21?
Yes, MC-12.
MC-12.
Yep. Yeah, militarized version of the B-350, the King Air B-350.
The King Air, yes. Right. So you're flying that in Afghanistan. About what era would that have been?
That was 2013 to 2014.
Okay. I have a little extra curiosity because I have a nephew who was in the back of the C-12s, possibly around that same time. So we'll have to compare notes offline at some point. What's the mission? And I understand that perhaps you can't disclose all of it, but what was the mission of the MC-12 under those circumstances?
So it's an intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance aircraft, and I can't say much more than that. But you know, we would be tasked with getting intelligence against a particular objective. We were also capable of helping control. We call it the stack. So we would have aircraft orbiting over a location. We might have other intelligence aircraft in the stack, and then you would also perhaps have some air-to-ground fighters in there as well, and you would manage that stack, and if there was a troops in contact situation, you would help facilitate the air-to-ground employment of weapons toward helping out our troops that were on the ground.
So we talked a little bit about the combat missions and your you know, duties in Iraq and Afghanistan, but what was your path after that, after you've come back stateside? Where have you gone? What was your progression?
Right, so I was in Afghanistan. I was a two-star at that time. And so my other than flying the MC-12, which I really only did about once a week, the rest of the time I had multiple different roles, but basically I was the senior airman in country. And so I was responsible for delivering air power to the joint force commander. And I also had the responsibility of training up the Afghan Air Force as they converted to our aircraft. After that, I came back and I was the director of operations for U.S. Central Command. About the time that ISIS came across the border from Syria into Iraq, I was running the operations for Central Command. After that, I was the 11th Air Force commander. I got promoted to 3-star at that point, which is all the air forces in Alaska, Hawaii, and Guam. Then I went out to Korea. I was the 7th Air Force commander in charge of the air operations in Korea, not just the U.S., but also the combined between the U.S. and the Republic of Korea. Then I came back from that, got promoted to 4-star, and I was the commander of Pacific Air Forces, which is all of the air forces in the Pacific. Then I moved to Air Combat Command, which is all of the air forces in the continental U.S. plus in the Middle East and the Central Command area of responsibility. And then I thought I was going to retire, and I went on terminal leave, moved to Tampa. I was flying my Lancer 3 times a week. It was a wonderful life. I had a hangar 10 minutes from the house. And then I got a call to come back, and I became the chief of staff of the Air Force in November of 25.
That is a truly remarkable progression. You know, one of the things that had come up in some of the earlier discussions with some of your staff, combined with the fact that that you mentioned you were a two-star when you're flying the MC-12. So number one, that's sort of surprising to me. We think of somebody of your rank and position, even forgive me, but 2 stars ago, as somebody who's probably going to fly to stay current. But was that out of the ordinary for somebody of that rank to be flying combat missions? You know, as you said, infrequently, but once a week is plenty frequent to me.
Well, I was certainly the highest ranking flying combat missions regularly, but we actually had some 1 stars flying, and that's not unusual for our service. We believe you should lead from the front,
right?
And I certainly have emphasized that in the commands that I've had, and since I became the chief of staff, I actually directed our commanders to get out and fly. I say the most important thing we do in the United States Air Force is fly and fix aircraft. And the commanders need to be intimately involved with both of those processes. And I tell them the fixing part is more important, because when you fix, then you can fly. And when you fly, you get reps and sets. When you get reps and sets, you can be proficient. When you're proficient, you create deterrent value, because really we'd love not to have any fights, and so we want to deter them. But if that deterrence fails, when you have those reps and sets, you're proficient and you can win. And so the commanders being involved at the detail level with the flying mission is incredibly important, because they will have a firsthand knowledge of the challenges, of the problems that need to be solved, of the support that their subordinates need to execute the mission. And they will actually just be leading from the front, which is what we want them to do.
So as an outsider, I would guess that certainly a lot of commanders, I mean, there's kind of a stereotypical image, and forgive me if this is a silly stereotype, but you think about pilots and getting promoted, and you're moving up through the ranks, and you're sort of getting to fly less and less, and you know, there's more sort of desk time or paperwork time or logistics, all these other things that go with it. I would guess that a lot of commanders welcomed that directive from you to get out and fly more. Was that true? I just can't see there'd be a lot of arm twisting.
Not a lot of arm twisting by the air crew. They certainly came into the Air Force because they wanted to fly, and as they've had a chance to do that, they certainly love it. But it's also the connection with the mission. You know, certainly it's great to go fly, and what an opportunity and a privilege. But the connection to the mission just helps them to be more effective commanders.
You're here.
General, one of the things you had mentioned, this is backtracking just a little bit. One of the things you had mentioned was you led the transition and training of the Afghan Air Force back when I think you were a 2-star. You had mentioned, what were some of the challenges of that? I mean, I kind of wonder, you know, I guess, one, what were they transitioning from, and what were they transitioning to, and what was that process like?
It was very challenging. So the pilots that we had that were left over from really when the Soviets were there and taught them how to fly, and so they were very Russian oriented and Eastern Bloc oriented, and so they had all of those habits that we had to break from the previous the ones that had previous time. The new crop, who we were training from the beginning of their careers, they were really easy to train because they didn't have their bad Russian habits. They also, we had a mix of U.S. and Russian aircraft. So we had the Mi-17 helicopters for them to fly. They were training in MD-530s. We had some C-208s, which were Cessna Caravans. And after I left, they got the A-29s. And so just training them to fly like Western pilots was really challenging. The youngsters took to it really well. Breaking the habit patterns of their more seasoned ones were pretty challenging.
General, would some of those Russian habits you're talking about, is that something, is I've read over the years that one of those big differences was, and it certainly somewhat relates to the ideology, the Soviet ideology, but was one of those habits the fact that they would be very reliant on ground control and sort of be looking for somebody else to do the directing versus having some autonomy and some ability to improvise and think on their feet?
Absolutely. I'll tell you a story to illustrate. So I was sitting in a safety out brief, and it was a MI-17 that they ended up overloading. It was very hot. It was high density altitude, and they took off and didn't have the power to get out of ground effect, and ended up running into the train and crashing the helicopter. And in the safety brief, they blamed the cause of the accident was the fact that there wasn't a weatherman at the out location where they landed. They landed at basically a forward operating base to change out some cargo, and they put way too much cargo in the helicopter. And so they blamed the accident on the weatherman instead of the pilots. And so the simple question was, well, why didn't you know you didn't have power? Well, because the weatherman didn't tell us what the temperature was.
Wow.
And I had flown the MI-17, and right in front of the pilot is a temperature gauge, like many airplanes have.
Oh, my God.
And I said, couldn't you have just read the temperature gauge and then done a little calculation and known that your engine's not going to produce the power? Oh, no, we couldn't have done that because, you know, we didn't have weatherman to tell us. And so it was that kind of mentality of shedding the blame to somebody else and not being a pilot in command and taking responsibility for your aircraft.
That's fascinating because, you know, even in the civilian world, you know, where I operate, that's, you know, that's ingrained in you from day one or day zero is, you know, the pilot in command. It's in there in the FARs, you know, you are responsible for everything. And I, you know, for some student pilots, it takes a little while for that to really sink in as their confidence builds. But that's just a, you know, a core tenet of flying, period. And then one would imagine we extrapolate that into the military environment, and it's that it would be even more so. But a telling example. I appreciate you sharing that story.
So, General, you know, as you kind of think back on your career and your experiences to this point, you said you were planning on being retired not that long ago. You're now Air Force Chief of Staff. What lessons, what values through your career or experiences through your career have shaped how you approach now this position?
When I was a young captain, which was in the 90s, I had an opportunity to go to our weapons school. And graduated from weapons school in 1992. And one of the things that they taught, two concepts. One is be a leader that is humble, credible, and approachable. Humble from the standpoint of, you know, think about who gets to go to weapons school. The very best of the best get to go to weapons school. And then when you get that education and training, you are just so good at your craft, because if you weren't, you wouldn't have graduated. And so you could get cocky. And that's not what we need. We want our graduates from the weapons school are instructors. And so we want people that are humble enough to continue to learn and get better. And then the credibility part of it is your colleagues that you're trying to instruct and teach and lead, you know, they have to see you as someone worthy of following. And that's where that credibility comes in. And then the approachable is we want our weapons school graduates to, you know, have people that will come up to them and ask them maybe what seems to be a dumb question, but they don't know. And we want our weapons school graduates to teach and lead. So that humble, credible, and approachable is something that I've brought with me all the way to the 4-star rank. And then the other part, which is a lot more probably tactical of how we do things, is the concept of plan, brief, execute, debrief. So when we get a mission, we sit down with the team, it's intelligence, it's obviously other operators, maybe the other forces that you're gonna be in this mission with, and you sit down around the table, probably with a map, and you figure out the plan. You know, what is the tactical plan gonna be? And then you get together and you brief it. And you go through the main plan and the backup plans and the tertiary plans and the what ifs, and then you go execute it, and then you come back and you debrief it. And in for training, it's in the debrief where you have the most learning. And in that debrief, it's very specific, and it's very pointed, and it's meant to be very constructive. And it can seem like if an outsider came in, they would think, wow, that's really direct and abrupt and maybe abrasive, but it's all about making each other better. And so when we get into the debriefing room, the rank comes off. And so even now when I go fly as a 4-star and I sometimes fly with a captain, and the captain will debrief me and I'll take the debrief and I listen and I try to learn and try to get better. And I will provide feedback for them as well. And it's all about getting better. And I've taken that concept of plan, brief, execute, debrief into every organization that I lead. Because if you have this feedback loop where the team is constantly trying to get better, even when things are going well, you still want to try to find things that you can do better. And if things didn't go well, you don't want to repeat that and you want to improve for next time. And so taking those two concepts into every organization that I've led is something that I have done and seems to be pretty successful.
General, it's really interesting to hear you stressing the debrief portion of it, because that's a thing I think when we see, you know, in the movies and things, you know, the mission's over, we're going to high five, you know, Maverick and Iceman are going to hug finally. And, you know, that's pretty much it. We don't usually see the debrief. So it's great to hear straight from your mouth the importance of that. I've sat in, done stories on a couple of the military demonstration teams. And so I've, you know, been in a room full of, you know, fighter pilots after, and I've been able to sit in on the debrief, and that was fascinating for me, because you had this room full of, you know, some of the best pilots I'll ever encounter. Absolutely. And they're impatient to rattle off the list of things, you know, well, at 2 minutes and 40 seconds, I was, you know, my pitch was 2 degrees low. And I was pulling, 0.2 fewer Gs than I should have. And when you would get around to somebody who couldn't find anything, you know, didn't think they did anything, they would sort of hang their heads and say, well, it was a personal best for me, this particular demonstration flight. And they were almost disappointed. Like they felt guilty that they didn't have something to say. And that humility, and I know it's a bit apples and oranges, I'm talking about a demonstration team, but still military, active military pilots. That humility and that emphasis on that growth and taking what we just did, that to everybody on the ground looked just flawless and incredible. But to then take that and grow with it was a profound experience for me. So it's heartening to hear you stressing that concept again.
I'm so glad you have had a chance to see that and how serious. I don't know if it was the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds or another demonstration team, but actually I just got to fly with the Thunderbirds on Friday as they practiced their demonstration over downtown Washington. I was with Rogue number 5, the lead solo, as we flew across Washington, D.C., they, just like you talked about, they debrief to that level, and they're extremely critical of themselves so that nobody else has to be. And that the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds have an extremely difficult demonstration to perform when you think about in all kinds of weather conditions, in a strange environment with, you know, sometimes buildings and mountains and certainly weather. The Thunderbirds, when they performed for the 4th of July here, they had 2 thunderstorm cells within close proximity of the demo, and the winds were swirling. Yeah, they had their hands full. And so to debrief at that level gives them the skills so that they can repeat a highly professional demo every week. Sarah, who's listening in, she was a Thunderbird. She was the Thunderbirds PA. So hopefully I did you well there.
Oh, thank you, Chief.
Yes. Wow. Okay. Well, Sarah, we thank you, of course, for your service as well. But that's that idea, what you've laid out, you know, that's something any of us can apply to our jobs. It's obviously a very different maybe set of stakes that we're dealing with. But we can all take a lesson from that.
General, as you kind of discussed prior, you know, we talked about your values and what you know, hope to bring and instill in airmen, you know, across the country. When we talk about priorities, you know, for you as chief of staff, is there anything in particular that you're looking to accomplish or you're hoping to lead the Air Force into accomplishing, you know, during your tenure?
Well, I have a lot of smaller goals, but the big ones are to improve the readiness of the Air Force and then to increase the modernization, to basically modernize the Air Force, and then to take care of airmen and families, because it's those airmen and families that will make the modernization and the readiness happen. Let me expand a little bit. So readiness is certainly important for today. And we just completed Epic Fury, and the Air Force did a phenomenal job with Epic Fury, with executing what the CENTCOM commander wanted us to accomplish there inside of Iran. And in order to do that, we had to have a level of readiness. And so we always are trying to improve that. Aircraft availability and aircrew proficiency are the two main parts of that. And then as we look to the future, we definitely need to modernize. We have a pretty old fleet. We've modified that fleet pretty well over the years, and we're still the greatest Air Force in the world despite having some old platforms. But we definitely want to bring in some more F-35s. We've got the F-47 coming in, which will be the first sixth generation aircraft. We're going to be modernizing the F-22. We have the B-21, which is doing great in test. We have the Sentinel intercontinental ballistic missile that's coming in to replace the Minuteman. And so we have a number of other, the T-7, the brand new trainer, which I had a chance to fly a few weeks back, the KC-46 with relatively new tanker to replace the KC-135. I also had a chance to fly that a few weeks back. And so we're bringing in some additional. We've got a number of modernization programs that will help us to transition into the future.
So will the B-52 and perhaps the C-130 still outlive all of those, do you think?
I don't know if they'll outlive the F-47 and the B-21, but we're going to have the B-52 for a while. Yes. We're modernizing that with new engines and a new radar, which includes a significant upgrade to the cockpit for the B-52. But the B-52 is so versatile.
Right.
We can do so many things with it that we want to keep it. Same thing with the F-15. You know, we're in the process of acquiring F-15 EXs, which is, you know, a new spin on a fairly old aircraft. You know, I started flying the F-15, and it wasn't even new when I started flying it in the 80s. And we're building, Boeing's building new F-15 EXs for them, and it's essentially the same airframe because it's an amazing airframe, but it's got some new engines, new avionics, new flight controls, and it's, again, extremely versatile. And it's a truck. It can carry some very large munitions, and it can go a really long way.
And it's such a testament to those designs. You know, we mentioned the V-22, the 130, you're mentioning the F-15. And it's funny, it was sort of jumped just a little bit. You say the F-15, and that's new. And I said, well, no, it's new because it first flew in my lifetime. And I find that, the older I get, the older new stuff is, or something like that. But it's a tribute to the airmen and the crews that have maintained those aircraft over the years, and that have found these ways to modernize them. It's a tribute to the original designers and the current manufacturers who take such good care of the aircraft and keep them going. So it's terrific to hear. I'll just say this: it's terrific to hear, as frankly, as a taxpayer, this mix of, you know, we're going to upgrade the things that work, and take advantage of the longevity that these aircraft are capable of, alongside, bringing in the new.
Well, I'll tell you, my dad, other than also teaching me to fly, he also taught me to be fiscally responsible. And as my role as the chief of staff, I'm very cognizant of efficient use of taxpayer dollars, so we get the most bang for the buck and provide the maximum capability for our nation's citizens to protect our national security.
Well, General, I think we're just about at the point in the conversation. We've got to ask you the most important question of all, and I say that with just nothing but bias. But as we're recording this, it is early July. We'll hopefully have this out kind of by mid-July. But right now, we are looking forward to you coming to Oshkosh and paying us a visit. So, are you excited about that?
I am so excited. I have been trying to get to Oshkosh for decades, and this will be my first time.
Wow.
And I get to come in style in an F-22. And I look forward to speaking with some crowds there. I hope to see you guys there as well.
Likewise.
And chat in person. And I know there'll be probably some people there that will want to chat with me as well. And I'm really looking forward to that. It's such an iconic, you know, really just an iconic event that I've been wanting to come for so many years. And I'm finally going to get a chance to go. So I am super pumped.
And as you said, you'll be arriving in style. Do we know the dates that you'll be here as of this point?
It's the 21st and the 22nd of July.
Oh, that's terrific. I would make a friendly wager with you, General, that as deeply grateful we are for your long service and especially for coming out of retirement, there will be a small part of you that looks forward to retiring again so that you can come back in your Lance Air and hang out all week.
No doubt. We'll make plans to do that.
Oh, we certainly look forward to that. Sam, anything else before we wrap it up here?
Well, I guess, you know, obviously you've seen most of the military stuff, or if not all of the military stuff that we will have at Oshkosh. Is there anything civilian that you really want to see when you're here?
I just really love hanging out, especially with owning an experimental aircraft. I love hanging out with the experimental crowd. And seeing what people are doing with their aircraft. I actually just put a new radio in mine that when I did my conditional this year. So I've got mine pretty tweaked out at the moment, but I always like to see what upgrades you can put in into your aircraft. And I love the experimental with the flexibility of not having to do certified and to really make the aircraft the way you want it. So I told my staff to put some white space in my calendar, which they rarely do. So I visit some booths. I also hope to get to see some of those YouTube stars that we all know and love. I'm sure they're going to be out there.
Not to mention your favorite podcast host, of course, but just throwing that out there. Well, General Wilsbach, we've said more than once, we mean it quite sincerely. We thank you so much for your service. You've had a remarkable and distinguished career, and we thank you for once again answering the call, coming out of retirement. As challenging as that might seem to some people, I think it's clear that that you are going to answer the call to duty, and we deeply appreciate it. We really appreciate your time coming on the show today. Our thanks to everyone on your staff who's been so helpful. Sarah we've gone back and forth, making sure this was going to go off without a hitch. And so we're grateful to her as well. And of course, we're always thankful to everybody out there listening. Without listeners, we obviously couldn't do this show. So we do ask you, though, to please, wherever you find this episode, leave it a like or a comment or a review. Every one of those episodes has a landing page on EAA's blog, inspire.eaa.org. You can find every episode there. There's a spot to leave comments, so we sure appreciate that. Reviews are more than welcome, and you can also always send us some notes and some compliments and some of that good constructive debrief feedback to the feedback@eaa.org email address. And we look at all of that, and we take it hard and do our best to as we have said, we want to be better every time. Although I got to be honest, and apologies to the next guest, whoever that may be. I'm not sure how quickly or easily we're going to top this one. But General Wilsbach, thank you so much again.
Well, thank you, Hal. Thank you, Sam. It's been a delight. Please pass along to your colleagues at EAA for all they do to facilitate our flying around the country, and especially in experimental aircraft. But for, you know, safe. And the tips for maintenance, all of the things that they do. But I'm so looking forward to seeing the great gathering at Oshkosh in a few weeks. Thanks for having me.
It's been our pleasure. And once again, everyone out there listening, we will catch up to you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.